Moncrief's TV on the Radio, where James Dempsey and I dissect, reflect and pontificate about the good, the bad and the ugly in TV land.
You see, people go in with a disposition that you're guaranteed to find someone who's, like, disabled. And if they don't, then it must have been a false diagnosis. Here's the thing. I'm not angered when someone points out that I have the disorder, and I'm not angered if someone says, ah, oh, you're not really. I'm not angered with either of them, as much as it might seem. I don't care about it. I really don't care. So, if it weren't for the fact that I agreed to this, I probably wouldn't be talking about the fact that I have autism at all.
There you go. That's a clip from Autism and Me. It was broadcast on Monday on RTE, but it's now available to be seen on the RTE player. James Dempsey is back, and this time. So, James, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
You're very welcome back to the show. Thank you. So, Autism and Me, obviously a documentary.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it pretty much explains what it is in the title. So it was about, I think, six really different people living with autism from various ages. There was a guy named Adam Harris, who's 22, who has Asperger's syndrome, and he kind of runs a sort of an advocacy group, I would say, that goes around to schools and talks about what it's like to live with Asperger's. Then there was Fiacre Ryan, who is a non-verbal guy who I'll come back to in a moment. He's 16. Neve Bidulph, I'm not sure, 19. Huey Malone, who we heard in the clip there, whose age I have put down on the sheet in front of me.
He's 19, I have.
He's not 19. Yeah. And okay. Dylan and Lee Burke, who are a pair of twins, and they're both 11. And it was a very interesting documentary, first and foremost, because it really did expose, or sort of highlight, I should say, rather, the kind of the grand differences of what it means to be on the spectrum of autism. Mm. Because really, it showed how it is a catch-all term that describes many, many different difficulties that someone might encounter in their life. Particularly noticeable in the case of Fiacre Ryan, who is a 16-year-old boy who, when you are first, as a viewer, see him, he is nonverbal, so he doesn't speak at all. He doesn't even seem to catch the eye of the people engaging with him. And his family members were saying that, you know, for most of his life, they really didn't know how much of the world he was taking in and observing. Mm. And then I think they said 3 years ago he started using this program that's called ORPM, which is sort of a sheet. It helps him to communicate. He points to letters and it is a way of communicating. And it is mind-blowing how articulate he is. I mean, I cannot stress enough how unbelievably beautiful his turn of phrase is. They get an actor to record his voice, and he's reading this actor some of the poetry that he's written. And I mean, it is like, let alone for an average person, you know, it is incredibly eloquent and beautiful. A 16-year-old person that, it is mind-blowing. It was just so interesting to see, I guess, to be confronted by your own prejudices as an average Irish person. To if you see someone who you are obviously incapable of diagnosing with any kind of, any kind of disorder, but you will make rash judgments based on how they behave in society, whether they're screaming in a supermarket or hitting themselves or anything like that. And you really do, you just don't have any idea of what's going on inside their head. Mm. And particularly with a non-verbal person, when they finally do get an opportunity or a tool that allows them to express themselves, even though that tool is limited in its, you know, in its use and its limitations of time and how that can make you frustrated and so on and so forth. But sort of unlocking what's inside was just absolutely fascinating and riveting and really just very, very interesting. Mm. So I think this is a prime example of the kind of programming that RTE can do that sort of actually in a way makes it that this is how it can compete with something like Netflix or Amazon.
Yes.
So they are always encroaching in the sort of dramatic spheres, we'll say. But this is a documentary that tells Irish life, exposes sort of things that we don't force ourselves to confront, and is just very heartfelt and warm and engaging and really, really interesting.
Mm. Was this would you have watched three or four in a series to find out more about these people?
I would have liked that because there was, you know, so many characters in it, and it was good. I mean, it's a full hour long, really, as a documentary, and the breadth of what they show is very interesting. It also has a few limitations, in my opinion. For example, the people involved are all quite young.
Yeah,
there's nobody older than 22. And it is very, I think it would be very intriguing to see how someone who's 52 and is living with autism, how they are getting around day by day, because, you know, 42 years ago, there wasn't the same kind of programs to sort of teach them the coping mechanisms to deal with the modern world and in how they have confrontational dealings with it. Mm. We saw with Adam Harris, him explaining, you know, we saw footage of him as a child in either like baby infants or senior infants, very early age in school, where he was having these tantrums and going and hugging and kissing all of his classmates. And sort of he was watching and giving this very interesting commentary, observing his own behavior, explaining why he was doing this or how he now sort of has escaped those kinds of behaviors. And he explained, like, if you could see me when I was 8, I would have been so much different. If you'd see me when I was 18, I was even so much more different. So it would have been intriguing and probably very distressing to see someone who's in their 50s, whose parental, you know, perhaps their parental support system no longer exists for them, because that is a concern that was raised by the parents of the two twins.
Yeah.
That, you know, what's going to happen to their two 11-year-old boys when they are not around to take care of them? It would have been very confronting to see that, but not necessarily, but confronting in the right way.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we have to see, really, in order to react as a society and take better care of each other.
When they asked that question, was there an implicit answer that perhaps there isn't enough?
I feel for documentarians when they're making an emotive documentary like this, because the truth is, as a human being, if you ask someone, you know, the mother of the boys, whose name I can't recall, which is bad on me, but we'll say Mrs. Burke because that's who she is. Mrs. Burke is answering, and she's saying, she's getting very, they're in a park and she's getting very tearful and upset. And as a human being, your reaction is to sort of pull back and leave her be and sort of give her space to cope. As a documentarian, you actually have to get in her face and shove the camera in the face and the microphone and go, expand on this, tell us more. And they didn't really do that in the piece, which is a humane response, but it's not perhaps the right documentarian's response.
Yeah.
But I understand fully, you know, I'm a human being.
So
I understand. I wouldn't have done it either.
Yeah.
So there was definitely an implicit understanding that these parents, who looked, I would say, maybe slightly older parents than the other parents in the documentary, had concerns, real concerns, and no answers.
Yeah. Okay, that sounds extraordinary. Right, a few bits of TV news. Life's Gonna Imitate Art for a Heinz ketchup ad.
I just think this is so bizarre. So eagle-eyed Mad Men viewers will have noticed that in a 2013 episode, Don Draper, the, you know, ad wonder man, goes along and he pitches to Heinz ketchup with this very sort of laid back minimalist approach, which is these three posters of a burger, chips and steak. And then he sort of folds down this acetate and it's past the Heinz. And he does it in his typical Don Draper-y, everything is magic and wonderful, but really I'm a horrible person at the end of it. And Heinz in the show passes on the pitch, but Heinz in the real world has accepted the pitch. So in New York, starting I think next month, and in Variety, the trade newspaper, they're going to run these, not the actual ads, but as close to the point that, you know, they are identical.
Yeah.
So it'll be the tagline, pass the Heinz. And they're going to credit the advertising agency. They have credited Don Draper with coming up with the creative. The copywriters were credited as Matthew Weiner and Aaron Levy, who are the two writers of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And they're running the advert. So it's
right. It's all very meta. Have they employed an actual advertising agency who suggested, let's steal this from the fictional advertising agency?
That would be the advertising agency, David Miami. So they are the ones responsible. Apparently he was watching the episode and he thought, that is a really, really good advert. They shouldn't have turned that down. And he pitched it at everyone. I'd say...
Has he done this before, I wonder?
The Mad Men people were probably like, give me some money and go for it.
Nice one. Right. Good news or bad news, depending on your point. interview. Yeah. Ed Sheeran's going to be in Game of Thrones. Tell me he's going to die in this episode.
If I knew that, I probably would be contractually obliged to not say so. But yeah, so he has been confirmed as being a cameo guest star, presumably in the background, probably stringing a guitar and singing about, you know, Galway girls, etc., in somewhere in Westeros. So it's going to happen at some point in one of the 7 episodes of the 7th season, which is arriving on July 16th. US time, but it will be simulcast at 2 a.m. in the morning here.
Right.
If you want to set your recorders, or it'll be in the night of the 17th as well. So he's not the first musician to take part in Game of Thrones. Eagle-eyed viewers would previously have seen Mastodon, which is this heavy metal band that I'm not personally too familiar with. Apart from that, there's Gary Lightbody of Snow Patrol has been in it, Will Campion, who's the drummer of Coldplay, and then Sigur Rós, the Icelandic band. So
if you didn't notice any of those people in Game of Thrones, I must say. Do they do musical things, or are they just walking in a third dead body on the right kind of thing?
Sigur Rós were playing the music at Joffrey's wedding to Duffy's wedding with the pie that did, you know, that one.
Yeah.
And then the other guys, I'm not quite sure what they were doing, but they weren't. Sigur Rós were actually playing and singing along. So they were. But as for what Ed Sheeran will be doing, it's all up in the air. Apparently, the producers said, anyway, they've been trying to get him for years because Maisie Williams, who is Arya Stark, is reportedly a huge fan.
Okay.
And so I suspect we'll see him in whatever part of Westeros Arya is in.
Right. And of course, we don't know where she's going to be in the coming series, or even if it's going to be there, if it hasn't been burned to a crisp by various dragons. Karen in Sligo says, "Welcome back, James. I missed you."
Thank you, Karen.
There you go. Just started Peaky Blinders. Oh my God, what a great show. Is season 3 coming to Netflix?
I presume it is. I mean, seasons 1 and 2 are, so, you know.
Bound to be.
Yes.
And Frankie says, "Will you please tell your listeners to check out This Is Us? I watched episode 15 on Channel 4 during the week. It's the best thing I've seen on telly for years. And as it does, it just gets better and better." Says Frankie, I don't know if that run has come to an end yet on Channel 4.
It just ended in the US last night, so I think Channel 4, a couple of nights ago, and Channel 4 I think is a few weeks behind, so it still has a while to go yet.
Ah, right, okay, there you go. Right, more shows to talk about with James, back in a couple of minutes.
The first thing I said, it wasn't just the mothers.
There was the dads too.
Thing about fundraisers,
they're vicious.
It's not the male grizzlies you gotta watch out for, it's the sow.
Tell me about Celeste Wright.
Something had to be wrong.
So elegant.
So volcanic.
Madeline McKenzie.
Things never blow over.
Once Madeline gets involved, they blow up.
Team Renata. First Team Madeline.
The battle lines were drawn right there.
So we're like seriously using the word murder?
There you go. There's a clip from Big Little Lies that started on Monday at 9 p.m. at Sky Atlantic, though it's been repeated multiple times, and you can probably download, I imagine, if you've got Sky, you can download the first episode. So a lot of hype around it. Nicole Kidman and Reese Witherspoon, two of the main people involved in it. James?
Very much so, two of the main people involved, because they're actually not only, you know, the two big name cast members, but they also are the producers as well. Separately, both of them went after this novel written by this Australian novelist named Leanne Moriarty. And it is originally based in Australia, in this affluent suburb of Sydney. And they both separately went after this to, you know, to option it for a movie or TV shows are basically the new movies. So they went after it anyway. And instead of going to war over it, they decided to come together and produce it. And they roped on board David E. Kelly, who people would know from the 90s as sort of the creator of everything that was prestige TV before we acknowledged that's what was prestige TV. So he's behind Ally McBeal, The Practice, Boston Public, Boston Legal, LA Law, all those nonsense. And he has written it. It's directed by Jean-Marc Vallée, who's this Quebecois, I think, director, who has previously made Dallas Buyers Club, Wild Demolition. Basically, it's got big pedigree behind it, and it's like all HBO dramas, big long credit sequence, and nicely shot, very stylish. It is property porn, no matter what, right? So there's a lot of affluence going on here, but it is very enjoyable. I really, really liked it. I also like the fact that there's only 7 episodes, so I know that it is a nice, digestible story.
You mean 7 episodes and it finishes,
yes,
and it doesn't come back for 7 more series?
So,
yeah,
yes.
Okay.
So the main thrust of the story involves all of these housewives, or not, that's not correct. They are wives and they have children, but many of them work, living in Monterey in California, which is this very well-to-do part of California where all the kind of tech billionaires live. And the sort of unifying thing that brings them all together is they all have a child in the first grade, so they're 6 or 7, and they're dropping their children off on the first day of school, and this sort of thing happens where this new woman named Jane, played by Shailene Woodley, who people would know from the Divergent series, and people would know her as like a YA actress who's now kind of breaking into the mainstream. She has appeared, she's poorer than the rest of them, she's Jane, and she's arrived with her son. There's a bit of mystery as to why she's there, and she helps Reese Witherspoon's Madeline out, and this sort of creates a friendship between them. And then something happens amongst the children where someone is accused of throttling another one, and that leads to this big schism which permeates the entire rest of the series. And it's all about the kind of warring factions of parents being pissed off with each other about each other's kids, but really the row was never about what the row was about, as my fathers want to say. And there's all these tensions going on. Now, some of the threads of the story are more interesting than others. The absolute star of it, I would say, in my opinion, is actually Reese Witherspoon. This is the role that she was like born to play, because she is really feisty and funny and snotty and bitchy, and she's like Desperate Housewives with all of the good things and none of the bad things. Mm. And she's great. Nicole Kidman, I could take or leave on a good day anyway, but I find her character the least interesting. She's in this room, she's got she's married to Stellan Skarsgård, who's Alexander Skarsgård, I should say, who's her husband Perry, and he's abusive, basically. And then Jane is sort of dealing with single motherhood and so on. And they just move around, but the real crux of the matter is we're split between two timelines as well, because we've got all the people we heard there in the clip are being interviewed by the police. Because what we learn is someone has been murdered.
Yeah.
We do not learn who has been murdered. And if you don't panic, if you don't find out by the end of the first episode, because you're not going to find out till the 7th episode who is murdered, because that's how it works in the structure of the novel. So it is this very long whodunit, and you'll be waiting a while to find out.
Okay, they're stealing a trick there from, I think, the first series of The Affair was kind of like
that. That's true, yes, exactly. So what works extremely well is they knit all the scenes together by sort of jumping to the police interviews, which are these very quick talking heads of all the background and really far background characters saying just as equally bitchy things as the mothers. And that is great. It has this great pace. It keeps everything moving nice and quickly. And because it's so few episodes, I mean, 7 is a very manageable amount of episodes, even if they're a full HBO hour at that. But because you know it's not going to go on and on and on forever and ever, like sort of, you know, like network series would ring this for 3 seasons, even like Pretty Little Liars or something, not telling you who A was forever and ever and ever. Because you know it's limited, it's manageable and it's digestible, and go in expecting it to be fun and just enjoy it.
Okay. That sounds great. James, can we talk about Designated Survivor on Netflix? God, it's so good. A new episode out tonight. I'm beside myself, says Laura.
Well, I'm not beside you because it didn't do much for me. I dropped out. I have seen a bit of, you know, buzz about it online, but not enough to make me dip back in. It's about, you know, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development accidentally becoming the US president when they're all killed during a State of the Union affair.
Right.
Speech,
I think we
say.
Did talk about
we
this
we did
before.
Talk about
yeah,
this
yeah.
unfavorably, but yeah. That, don't let that distract from your enjoyment of it.
Okay. John in Limerick says, I've never watched Game of Thrones. Am I really missing something? Life's too short for fake fantasy. Fantasy by its definition is fake, I would have thought. Lyrics from a Mastodon song, I killed a man because he killed my goat. I put my hands around his throat. I have never watched Game of Thrones, but I might now, says John Joel from Leash. That's pretty much like a plot of Game of Thrones, come to think of it. I am only a recent convert. I only recently caught up with it, I think it is. The thing about it is, it's really well plotted. It's really, really well plotted.
And it's really funny.
Yes, and it's very surprisingly funny.
Yeah, and that's so important in a long running drama like that, because if you want to catch up, you know, we're talking like 73 hours in total. It's what it's going to be by the end of it, which is a lot of time. So at least it doles it out really satisfyingly, and it's funny and shocking, and avoid all the spoilers that you can.
Yeah, and don't get too fond of any character in this. Right, so the last show we're going to be talking about today is Love. Here's a clip.
So I told Gus that I didn't want to date for a year, and then we had sex in my car. Is that bad?
Well, you're a sex addict, right?
And love, yeah.
So maybe having sex right now is like risky and ill-advised?
I think that I was going over the top with the year thing, and I'm going to meetings, which I wasn't before, and I think that I'm being honest, and I genuinely do like Gus, so I think it's fine. I think it's just like a funny story.
Yeah, it is. Actually, it's pretty funny, because it's like, you shouldn't be doing it. You're outside in a car, so it's probably uncomfortable. Yeah.
There you go, that's Love. That's from season 2, which has just come out. All 12 episodes of that are available on Netflix. Obviously somebody with a problem justifying continuing with the problem.
Yes, exactly. So Love is an interesting show. It's more interesting than it is, I think, likeable, but it has enough charm, definitely, that when you kind of fall for it, it's very easy to consume the episodes so quickly because they're all there, and it definitely benefits from that. It stars, and I'm not pronouncing this incorrectly, Gillian Jacobs. She is Gillian, as we would say, with a G, but her mother didn't know that that's how you pronounce Gillian, and now and she is Gillian.
Okay.
So people would know from Community, where she was Britta,
yeah.
And Paul Rust, who actually also writes the show along with his wife Leslie Arfin, I should say, and Judd Apatow, who people will know from all those movies that are at least 20 minutes longer than they need to be. And that is, I suppose, what was my major concern, was Judd Apatow makes very good movies, and he also makes them worse than they could be, because he doesn't know how to edit them. And the first series of this was a little bit like that as well. The episode length varied a lot. Some of them, you know, went over 40 minutes, some of them were about 25. And this season is a lot more structured and sort of well behaved, and definitely benefits from that. So by this time round, we've learned that they're, you know, this couple, Mickey and Gus, Mickey being Gillian, she is struggling with various addictions to both sex and love, but also substance abuse. And he is not the sort of nice guy that he kind of first appears. Not that he's a bad guy, but he's a bit more complex than you first think he is. He's an on-set teacher who wants to be a writer, TV writer at the same time. And clearly they're not supposed to be together, but they just really like each other to the point of potentially loving each other. And they have excellent on-screen chemistry. That is without a doubt. They're extremely watchable, and everyone in the whole thing is extremely watchable. But it's also kind of like this Curb Your Enthusiasm thing where you know stuff is going to happen and it's going to be bad.
Yeah.
And you just can't escape it. So it's a bittersweet show to watch, because look, I can tell you now, having not finished it, I feel like it's going to end badly, because this is someone
it always does
and she has addiction issues that she's not dealing with, and they shouldn't be together, and they are together, so this is not going to go well. So it is intriguing to watch, and as I say all the time, 30 minutes is my absolute sweet spot of a length for a TV show. That wins me over immediately anyway.
Yeah.
So it is great. I like it a lot. But you have to put in the hard work to kind of get to that point.
Yeah. Connor in BlackRock wants to know, any thoughts on Fleabag? I saw a few episodes. It's brilliant.
Fleabag is excellent.
Yeah.
That was really one of my favourites of last year. And the good news, it was on BBC Two, so a lot of people would have missed it. It had this kind of graveyard shift. If you want to go the legal route, which is what we recommend, you can, I think, now get it on Amazon Video Prime. So it is available and well worth seeking out. You'll watch the whole thing in about 3 hours, and excellent.
Right. And somebody else wonders, why do you never talk about Broadchurch? It's amazing. That's because we're too busy pushing the gay and pro-Islamic agenda to actually fit that in. James, thanks a million for coming into us today. That's James Dempsey there. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
More from TV on the Radio every Thursday on Moncrief from 3:00.